Society in general is much more focused on risk.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So today's guest, Sophie Ellis, is a researcher at the Prisons Research Centre at Cambridge University. She's interested in the experience of imprisonment for those who live and work in prisons, and also in the effects of prisons on families. She's also interested in the intersection between the PSY disciplines and state institutions. Before arriving at Cambridge, Sophie spent 9 years working in prison-based psychology roles, doing assessments and group-based cognitive behavioural programmes with prisoners. Sophie's PhD is looking at the role of psychologists in English prisons. It explores their history, their culture, their professional identity, and how they make decisions about deploying their power and expertise in a socially and morally complex environment like prison. Welcome, Sophie. We're delighted to have you on here today.
Absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Hello, Sophie. Yeah, it's very nice to meet you, and thanks for coming along. So can I begin with the question, why does what psychologists do in prisons matter?
Well, I think firstly because anything done in prison matters, in the sense that it's an environment where people are deprived of their liberty, and therefore they're very dependent on how things are done by the people running that environment. That has a fundamental impact on prisoners' quality of life and on their freedom. And psychologists have increasingly come to play a prominent and a powerful role in how prisoners experience their imprisonment. Firstly, at an individual level, many more people are being given some form of indeterminate sentence, which means that their release is often in some way contingent on undertaking rehabilitative activities. And psychologists will often be directly involved in the delivery of things like dependent behaviour programmes and treatment that targets psychological factors. And if they're not involved in direct delivery, then they'll have supervisory or managerial oversight in some way. And they'll also complete psychological assessments of risk and need and so on. And we know that psychologists' judgments of risk are often quite heavily relied upon by other decision makers like probation and the parole board. And psychologists also provide a lot of advice and input to prison staff on the management of prisoners and regimes more generally. So basically, if you're anything other than quite a short-term prisoner or classified as low risk, then it's quite likely some part of your prison sentence has been influenced by the actions of the psychologist. And so many decisions about prisoners are tied to notions of risk and rehabilitative progress. So what psychologists do is important because they feed into issues of liberty and well-being via their involvement in those kind of things in prison life.
Do you think psychologists always appreciate how much power they have? I was just thinking about when I first qualified, and as a newly qualified psychologist, you're often feeling like you're the person with least experience in the team, but by virtue of having this extra higher education, it does kind of imbue you with some additional power within a team. And I'm not sure, without certainly a ward manager pointing out to me that I was a senior staff member just because I was a psychologist, I'm not sure that I would have quite realised how much I had.
So it's really interesting that you frame the question as, do you think psychologists realise they have power, rather than a more blunt kind of, do psychologists have power at all? Because I think there's quite a bit of literature now establishing that psychologists do have a lot of power, and there's a bit on what that power feels like for prisoners and what it can feel like for psychologists as well. And I think you're right, sometimes, particularly early on in your career, you're not aware that actually the decisions that you make can have really quite tangible consequences for the prisoners in your care. And I think with any kind of power, particularly state power, it then becomes very important to understand how does it flow and how does it operate. And there's still loads to learn about that with prison-based psychologists. We know that psychologists perhaps don't especially like having power or the notion that they have it. It's quite an uncomfortable thing to hold. But beyond that, the way that, in which it flows has mainly come from listening to prisoners' experiences of how they experience what psychologists do with them. And I guess we can come on to this in a bit, but that's where I initially got very interested in this topic, was reading the literature on how prisoners experience what psychologists do.
I think it's a really interesting area, isn't it? Because if one thinks of medics, doctors of medicine, that is, often prison staff, prison governors in particular, are a bit wary of medics because they feel they have a kind of trump card which threatens their kind of control of security, really. But it sounds to me as if you're suggesting that psychologists have a different kind of power to that. Is that right?
So my supervisor at the Institute, Ben Crew, talks about this concept of psychological power and the pains of being subjected to that. And a lot of that is to do with the power of psychological discourse and expertise and language and how that can be deployed. So you think about us doing a risk assessment and, you know, we're there to talk through and make sense of someone's problems and issues. We can sometimes have quite a tendency to use quite global labels, you know, impulsivity, antisocial personality, these kinds of things. And that can be quite dehumanising to have yourself depicted and reduced to a classification of that nature. And prisoners tend to talk about feeling misrecognised, that the complexity of their experiences and the way that they make sense of their lives is almost kind of taken apart like pieces of a jigsaw and then put back together again, but not with the same picture that they see themselves in. But because psychologists are psychologists and are therefore imbued with expert power, it's kind of their testimony that often is the one that's taken as valid. There's plenty of accounts of prisoners feeling quite distressed at you know, here's this version of me that's being handed around to everybody, but that's not my version of me. And of course the power of once those depictions are written down in a psychological report, which then goes in a parole dossier, which is then viewed by the parole board, and which then again it comes back to those tangible consequences of freedom. Perhaps not sure quite the same as medical power, but certainly probably just as pervasive nowadays anyway.
Thank you. So we've mentioned your PhD and your PhD topic. What's brought you to be interested in this particular area?
Primarily from working in it. I mean, it was nearly a decade of my life, and I absolutely love working with the men. Sorry, I say men because I've never worked with women prisoners, so prisoners in very male terms. My favourite place to be was in a group room or an individual session, and you know, you get this enormous privilege of standing alongside someone and walking with them whilst they figure some things out about their life and what they want to do with it going forward, and then, you know, hopefully offering them some help to get there. That was meaningful to me, very meaningful. And it's, you know, it's very delicate work because fundamentally you're asking people to trust you in a very dangerous environment, and that's a big ask. So it's important to do it well. And it's the strangest job in the world as well, because on one level it's almost unbearably tragic. You know, you're often dealing with very dark things that people have been through and have done, and you're doing it in one of the bleakest environments. But, you know, you also get to be around people who somehow make sense of that bleakness and that tragedy and push through it in ways that, you know, would all of us do that? I don't know. But prisoners, you know, very talented, very funny, very clever, and group work at its best, you know, that's a really rewarding place to be. And it's a great job for colleagues too. You know, you're all thrown together very tightly in a very tough place, and you know, some of my best friends in my life are from that time. But there was a kind of a caveat to all that, which grew over the years. And, you know, you retain quite vivid flashbulb memories of times in your life that are meaningful. And I can see myself still sat in my office in the prison that I was sat in, I worked in at the time, sorry. And I read a paper by Ben Cree, my supervisor, on pains of psychological assessment. And reading this sociological account of what I was doing just kind of hit me like a brick. And even then, it still didn't happen overnight, but it helped me to see the social nature of what we were doing and the really pervasive nature of expert power. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to be the person doing that, or if I was going to, then I wanted to be really equipped with the knowledge and skills and maturity and wisdom, I suppose, to be able to do it. And I developed a bit of a different notion of the sort of psychologist that I wanted to be, and what I hoped for psychologists to be doing in prisons. And eventually I thought, well, I'm not going to get there with the sort of training and the sort of position that I was in. So I had to find a different way of making a contribution. And it's certainly, you know, people hear the story and they think it was like I immediately set out on some mission. It was actually a very convoluted path to Cambridge and to the Prisons Research Centre. I actually did an entirely different study for a bit. But kept coming back to, oh, this is important. You know, this is an important thing that's happening that not a lot of people outside of it really know about. And it seemed worth doing to me.
I think that's a really nice summation of what you obviously regard as a very positive experience, and I think I can recognise that myself. But I mean, thinking about Professor Crewe, because I think also in some of his research, he's described how many prisoners are frightened of psychologists. So. How does that balance up with what you've just been describing?
Yeah, I think that's something that we have to face up to, that of course anyone that wields that much power over what's going to happen to you is going to be a bit frightening. And it's uncomfortable and it's not very nice, especially when you sort of think, well, I've got the best intentions here, you know, I'm trying to help you. Why won't you be helped? You know, but as I say, when you look at it sociologically as a product of the system and the institution, it makes complete sense, and it kind of means that in a way, good intentions aren't good enough. We have to accept that we're working in a particular system that makes us into this very powerful. Not often well-liked set of people sometimes.
It actually resonates, though, with all forms of psychology and psychotherapy as well, actually, doesn't it? That as authority figures, you know, there's too often, I think, we approach the client, the patient, on the basis of we have good intentions, we smile, we'll be nice to them, and expect people to easily trust in us. But actually, if your experience is the people who should have been looking after you in childhood and taking care of you weren't nice to you and didn't treat you well, there's, you know, no reason why these total strangers that are being paid to come and take this role in your life are going to do that without maliciousness or with kindness. So I think we too often just take it for granted and assume that we'll be viewed as kindly and well motivated, when of course for the people that we're interacting with, that isn't necessarily the case.
And I think we need to bear in mind, you know, so for example, in a risk assessment, you know, say you are building that rapport with someone and it's all going rather well, and they confide in you, you know, 5 unconvicted offences, and then that turns up in their risk assessment report and has implications for what's going to happen to them. You know, there's almost a sense of betrayal there often, and obviously hopefully you can mitigate that by clearly setting out what you're there to do and the limitations of your role and confidentiality and so on at the start. But it's a very kind of artificial situation of, you know, oh, let's sit down and have this, you know, nice chat, but actually the way that the things that chat could be used for are things that are to do with your liberty.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks, Sophie. So moving on, what is your approach to studying prison-based psychologists?
As a prison staff group, but more importantly as people, right? You know, in a lot of the literature that's been written about prison-based psychology, psychologists themselves are often quite curiously absent from the text. You know, there have been some fantastic efforts to frame current issues with the profession. I mean, I'm thinking of things like Therese Gannon and Tony Ward's paper, for example, called Where's the Psychology Gone? It's really good, but often the focus is on the psychology less than the people doing it. And similarly, you know, the kind of classic history that we're taught of forensic psychology is often narrated as a bit of a relentless march of science and progress. But psychologists are people just like anyone else. They're social beings, and they have a social order, a culture, a history, and it's driven by people, not just by science. And also, they're people with a moral conscience, just like anybody, and therefore their values matter, not just their methods, although obviously the two are quite linked. So my approach is primarily sort of social, and I retain a particular interest in the history, because, you know, a social system doesn't spring out of nowhere, right? And also their actions as moral agents, because they're working at the sharp end, if you like, of state decision making, their moral agency really matters. And I kind of came to the realization that to do a proper job of understanding this you know, marvelously complex phenomenon, you can't do it only with recourse to psychology, if that makes sense. You have to make sense of the social and the cultural and the institutional system that psychologists inhabit and have to navigate. Which can be very tough sometimes.
Thank you.
I'm interested in this idea of kind of like weaving together the historical, social and moral perspective. And again, I suppose there are aspects that seem quite absent from the consciousness generally of psychologists in all branches. And I wondered how you came to the conclusion that you needed to pursue each of these strands.
I had the luxury of doing it because I had the wonderful opportunity to be in a very multidisciplinary environment. I'm in a place where I can have the time and the expertise around me to explore all of these different schools of knowledge, and I'm very grateful for that. That's a very rare thing for psychologists or anybody to get. It's been a real privilege to be able to do it, and I gradually kind of traced out those three things from the basic premise that psychologists have power in prison. And I do enthusiastically direct everybody to Jason Ward's work if they want to understand the nature of that power, because he's forged that argument very well. But the question then becomes, well, how do they use it? How do they think about it? And for a long time, I thought about that as a psychologist in terms of ethical practice, right? Because that is in our consciousness. We're trained to think about ethics and to be ethical practitioners. But I have to thank my colleague Ben Jarman for luring me into the world of moral anthropology. He looks at the moral world of life sentence prisoners. And that really got me to the point of understanding that ethics are a kind of abstract set of aspirations that we might have for ourselves, right? They're an ideal. But morality is the actual set of beliefs that we hold about the right and the wrong way to do things in certain scenarios. And of course, psychologists have to make choices all the time about what they do, and they're often quite high-stakes choices, and they have to decide what do they think is morally right, and they have to maintain, you know, to survive, they have to maintain a sense of themselves and their profession and their power as legitimate, and therefore that they're doing things on a rightful basis. So I became very interested in, well, how does that happen? What is the moral architecture underlying how psychologists think about the rightfulness and the legitimacy of their work? And then the step beyond that is, well, that moral architecture arises out of a social system, right? Where do psychologists learn how to be psychologists? It's been fascinating interviewing people about, you know, their first day in the psychology department, for example. And, you know, people learn from the culture that they enter into. And prison-based psychology has a particular culture. It has levels of status and hierarchy. It has in-groups and out-groups and social rules and traditions and demographics. You know, just like any other professions whose sociology has been a bit more researched. So the social kind of wraps around the model. And then the historical stuff came in during COVID when it was a bit of a waiting game to see if fieldwork in prisons was going to be possible. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to do it myself. So I started delving into the textual archive of psychology in prisons, trying to answer questions like, well, how did psychology become the very particular entity that it is in prison today? You know, it didn't just spring from nowhere in this form. There are dozens of things that we could be doing in prisons that we don't do, for example. So I wanted to know, how did we get here? And that's where I realised there's a story to be told here, a history that can account in a lot of ways for why things are the way they are now.
And I think, you know, hopefully we'll get to explore each of those perspectives, because there's all sorts of questions that stem from each of them. But I suppose we've spoken quite a bit about the power that psychologists have. But I suppose I also would be really interested to hear that question turned on its head, because I think psychologists do have a lot of power, but at times there is an awful lot more power in the system than that psychologists can feel they're up against. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. You know, if you're trying to implement change and the rest of the institution doesn't want to do that, or if you feel your moral position is at odds with a position that's really well established within the culture of an institution, where does that leave psychology?
So there's been some great stuff written on this kind of thing in the legitimacy literature. Tony Bottoms and Justice Tankerby here at the Institute have written on kind of this concept of junior power holders. You know, people that are given a little bit of power and are often kind of directly on the front line exercising that power over the powerless, if you like. But above them, there are senior power holders and powerful systems that really constrain what it is that the junior power holders can do. And for me, that totally speaks to the position that psychologists occupy. You know, they're often the ones held directly responsible for by prisoners for decisions about various aspects of their sentence. But, you know, we all know that often psychologists might want to recommend something that simply just isn't available in the system, and they're still tasked with doing something about it. So I think the culture of prison as an institution and the power of prison operates on psychologists as much as psychologists operate power on prisoners. It's a system. It's not a simplistic case of one group oppressing another.
Yeah, it's a really complex position, isn't it?
Mm. And one that psychologists get enormously frustrated by.
Yeah, absolutely. Just thinking about these three different perspectives, has that approach changed how you see psychology compared to when you were a practitioner?
Oh yeah, hugely. I mean, I can only speak for me personally, but I felt that I knew quite a lot, but about very little, if that makes sense. Like, it's a niche area that you come to understand a lot about, but I must confess I really was not aware of the connections between psychology and psychology in prison and prisons in general, how the broader politics of criminal justice feed into that, broader developments in society, forensic psychology's connection to mainstream psychology and to criminology and to broader studies of crime. You know, I found it really helpful to learn just the very basics of prison history, for example. And I now kind of see terms like rehabilitation and public protection in much more complex terms than I did. You know, putting them in kind of philosophical and historical context has been quite helpful for me. And I've got to say, working at the Prison Research Centre has taught me a lot about treating prisoners with dignity and respect, and the various ways of making theoretical sense of their views and experiences. I think psychology can sometimes, we've already touched on this, but it can be quite epistemically violent in its language, just through those kind of global terms.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think I've learned a lot about incorporating social context in a theoretical understanding of how prisoners experience prison. Don't get me wrong, I'm still a great fan of psychology and its potential, and I'm happy to make what I hope are informed criticisms of it precisely because I really believe in its potential. But I think it needs more critical friends, which is exactly what I've had from the luxury of kind of interdisciplinary dialogue and debate. Because fundamentally the work is enormously complex and difficult, and I think we need and are maybe even obliged to have a range of schools of thought at our disposal. One of the competencies in the training for forensic psychologists is, I can't remember exactly how it's worded, but it's something like promoting the value of psychology services to other stakeholders. And, I wish there was an inverse competency about something like being able to appraise the value of other schools of knowledge and expertise to psychological practice. I wish that was kind of a two-way thing.
Absolutely. I think quite often psychologists working in prisons seem to be operating in a silo, don't they? And I think one of the things that I've really valued about doing this podcast is the number of conversations we've had with criminologists where I've read their books prior to us interviewing them, and really wishing I'd paid more attention and read some of that work much earlier in my career. But I wonder whether prison-based psychologists face more barriers to working in an interconnected manner than psychologists working in other areas. Does it encourage silo thinking?
I'm prepared to have my mind changed on that. I'm not sure I'm far enough on in the research yet, but I'm leaning at the moment towards saying yes, and it's simply to do with the existence of the prison wall. Obviously, we know it's about much more than a physical wall, but prisons are walled-in institutions in many senses. They're quite a closed world, not just for prisoners, but for the staff as well. And we often operate very internally, and you certainly feel once you leave, it becomes a nightmare to access basic information that you took for granted before. Definitely, come up and smack my face in the wall trying to get at things that were so easy before. So I think psychologists are they're very much absorbed into the prison and the prison's way of doing things, simply because that's what prisons do. So I think there are barriers to interconnectedness, and I don't know if they're any worse than for other sub-disciplines. I can't really compare, but I think the very existence of sub-disciplines in psychology can create silos as well, right? What I've found sometimes fascinating, sometimes depressing, and sometimes hopeful is that in my oral history interviews with psychologists who trained and worked in prisons up until around the early 90s, this silo situation was definitely not always the case. It's not a natural, a given. It's the product of a particular period in psychology's timeline and didn't always exist. So in the 70s, 80s, 90s, it's quite amazing, despite having much less technological capacity to connect, psychologists working nationally in prisons across the country were much more connected to each other, and to psychologists outside of prisons too. I think that was helped by the simple fact that there were fewer of them in prisons, but there was also more networking events and training brought people together from across the country at quite regular intervals. People used to spend 1 week in every month together away from the prison on training, which kind of forged professional connections for life, really. And also at that time, forensic psychology was not a distinct specialism. So there was a much more porous blending of psychologists doing different things with different theoretical perspectives and getting a range of psychologists in to do training as well. But the trade-off seems to be that whilst they were more connected to each other, they were less connected with the prison. And see much more by the prison as outsiders than they are now. So there's pros and cons, and a number of things happened in the 90s, but one of them was the formal establishment of forensic psychology as a practitioner specialism. And there was other kind of restructuring of prisons and how they ran. I think a combination of these things kind of pushed forensic psychologists together to start developing a distinct professional identity that wasn't really there before, where there was maybe less room for plurality of thought. And they were also pushed further into the prison, maybe not so much pushed as maybe went along fairly happily, and away from the wider psychologist community and forged their own path from there. That's kind of where I'm at the moment in my understanding of the trends that, and the changes that have led us through the last few decades.
That's really interesting, because it sounds as though, you know, as a collective, that psychology might have sacrificed the kind of the wider networking in order to gain more acceptance within prisons and manage the day-to-day interactions that they had to face within those establishments, because sometimes those can be quite fractious, can't they, and quite difficult. Because having worked in hospital settings and community settings, my experience is that prison psychology is much more of a silo than other branches of psychology. And that, I suppose, partly kind of like training as a clinical psychologist, you do placements in different client groups. Mm-hmm. And so you're training alongside people who will go and work with children or older adults. Mm-hmm. And so you naturally end up knowing people in different settings anyway. And then also you're working alongside different disciplines in a team quite often, where you're hearing their opinions. Whereas I think often in a prison, psychologists with their higher education are viewed differently, as if there's more status to their opinion, more gravitas to their opinion, by virtue of their higher education. And I wonder if that's perhaps not helpful for psychology.
I think certainly a bit of a trope in prison psychology is, well, there are many, but one of them is this sort of ivory tower complex, this perception that, you're up there in your office, don't really know what you do, you know, you descend to see us plebs occasionally and then you swan off again. It's often the kind of perception that psychologists have to deal with, which, you know, is not... I don't think there's an intention there. I think it's just the way that the job is set up and the very much competing responsibilities of psychologists, especially if you're involved in programs, having to manage that on top of all your other psychology work, I think it creates unintentionally quite a lot of distance from other areas of the prison. But as I say, much less so than previously, I think. Psychology really has made an effort to integrate itself, which has come with pros and cons.
I think this reminds me of a similar dilemma in hospitals, where you quite often get one or two psychologists working in a ward and they have to find a way to navigate the relationships with nursing staff. And again, there can be the accusation there that psychology is, you know, in its ivory tower, when in fact... It's also quite intimidating if you're a new staff member going to work in that service and you've got a big nursing team who view psychology as being a bit up themselves, and you're being met with a hostility. And there's something about how you manage to broker that arrangement and that relationship with this very large group of staff who actually collectively have a lot of power, and how you manage to do that without hacking them off, but also without compromising your autonomy as a professional and your need to stand up for your profession and your profession's views and aims and objectives. So it's tricky from both sides, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the main players in this story is actually not the prison, it's the training route, and who that brings into the prison in the first place. I mean, I nearly dropped my coffee in one of the first interviews I did, asking people about what the training route used to be like, because it was shorter, more straightforward, more definite, and not nearly so much asked of people in order to be deemed fit to practice. Now, obviously, you can argue that a lot of those structures are brought in for a reason. I'm not aware yet of any kind of empirical evidence that ballooning the training, you know, has resulted in measurably better practice. Maybe that exists, I don't know yet, but certainly because training was comparatively more was easier and more accessible, it meant that you were getting in psychologists from a much, or trainee psychologists from a much wider backgrounds. Because for a start, the prison service ran its own master's course by Birkbeck University. So you would need to kind of emerge with your psychology undergraduate degree, you would get that job, prison service would pay for the lot. People often had a bit of experience in something else first, so some of them had done things like mental health nursing. I mean, I'm sure that's still the case today, but the sort of tales that people tell of that cohort are a much wider range of ages, because people have done something else first and then come to it, a more even gender balance of men and women. Then we have the kind of increasing tightening of training where, now one must have a master's degree before you can even touch the training role. It's all linked into the broader marketization of higher education as well, where basically training is starting to cost a lot of money. And the sort of people that can afford to do it end up coming from backgrounds further and further away than those in prison.
Yeah.
Which I don't think helps with, cultivating relationships with a wide range of people.
No, absolutely.
I think this area of tribalism that we've just been talking about is very important. It's reminding me that for many years I sat on the board of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy. Mm. And I don't think I ever saw a forensic psychologist at any of the conferences or anything. But I also know that I was, for almost the entirety of the time I was involved, the only person who actually worked inside a prison. So you might have psychiatrists who visit prisons and assess people, or you had people who worked at Broadmoor who had some sort of working contact with prisons. But in my mind, they weren't people who actually got their hands dirty doing the job that psychologists do in prisons.
Yes, and this is where I think that, there are a lot of legitimate criticisms of what psychologists do and how they do it, but we mustn't lose sight of the fact that they're doing it in an extremely difficult place, and they are getting their hands dirty, as you say, often in a place where, changing the system is a gargantuan task for anybody. And I think that's precisely the point. No individual can do it. And what's required, perhaps really, to take on some of these issues is a collective response, which is what's kind of falling away, as far as I can tell, with psychologists. Maintaining our connections is something that we've let go of it.
Great. Prison-based psychologists are often seen to be acting more as agents of the state than psychologists in other sectors, even if they are also working in statutory agencies. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And I'm not sure I know the answer to it yet. But my instinct is that there's two possible reasons. Because yes, I agree with you that although we could argue the complexities of what acting as an agent of the state actually means and who is doing it to a greater or lesser degree, the stark truth of the matter is that prisoners very much see prison psychologists as agents of the state, which causes all sorts of problems and massive legitimacy issues. So I think there's two possible reasons why we've arrived at that. One is that society in general is much more focused on risk, right? We're not unique in that respect, and I urge anyone interested in that to read about the notion of the risk society, Ulrich Beck, among others, to really understand just how risk averse we've become everywhere. I think when you've lived in it for so long, potentially all your life, it's hard to imagine things being any other way. One feature of the risk society is an increased perception that it's the state's responsibility to control risk. Now, there's risk everywhere, but it's much easier to locate risk in individuals than in systems or in corporations, right? Because it's easy to do something about individuals. So we now construct people who have committed crime as risky, which means that prison psychologists are working at one of the densest concentrations of the notion of risk, and in one of the institutions tasked with controlling it. And that institution in turn has kind of welcomed psychologists as assessors of risk, because psychological methods of measurement kind of lend themselves quite well to risk assessment. And over recent years, we've become perceived as, you know, experts in one of the state's most prized tasks. I think risk management is creeping into other state agencies as well. Tarek Yunus is a psychologist who's actually done some great work on looking at the use of prevent in healthcare settings. You should get him on this podcast. But my perception is that psychologists in healthcare settings, they're a bit buffered against those effects because of their commitment to psychological health and to reducing distress. You know, their job is to help people. But because of the rise of programs in prison focused on reducing reoffending and risk management and done in the name of public protection and so on, it's those things that have become prison psychologists' raison d'etre rather than the psychological health of prisoners. Not to say that individual psychologists aren't, you know, they care very much about the psychological health of prisoners, but collectively, institutionally, that's not necessarily foregrounded as a reason. And prisoners sense that. You know, they know that the aim is to stop them committing crime, not to help them feel better, even though feeling better might be framed as a necessary step along that road. It's still for the sake of the state's aims. So I think what distinguishes psychologists in prison is maybe their alignment with state aims as much as state agencies.
This is similar in a way to the shift that occurred within probation, similar to the shift that occurred within the social work field, where social workers had to move from being supportive individuals to managing the risk to children. Similar pattern of development, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's again, because we as a society in general are increasingly concerned with our job being to control risk and to be seen publicly to be doing that. What worries me now is that, and I include myself in this, that this kind of way of doing things has been around for a while. And, you know, people are not trained in anything different. I certainly wouldn't have thought, or wasn't even aware of these kind of broader social trends when I was working in prisons.
Hey, what you've been saying reminds me a lot of the kind of discussions stroke arguments that used to happen in Grendon 20 years ago, whether we were there to manage the risk of the people in our therapeutic communities, or whether we were there to help them develop their mental well-being. And I'll just read you out a short sentence from a letter which was written by the head of the Offending Behaviour Programme Unit just over 20 years ago, and he wrote under the, and this was to the head of the prison management group, under the heading of Last Refuge of Psychotherapy, the therapeutic communities have represented a cosy little backwater in which the form of treatment has been able to survive free from the rigours of empirical inquiry into its efficiency. So that was a kind of, that would be a good historical document.
Yeah, can I have that, please? Yeah.
And but of course, things have shifted now, haven't they? So that within the PD, Personality Disorder Pathway group rubric is the phrase not just to alleviate or reduce risk, but to help the emotional well-being of the people we're working with.
Well, it's that thing of cycles, isn't it? I mean, you know, prisons are very good at rediscovering old ideas, and I kind of get a feeling from the PD pathway. It's framed slightly differently in terms of its rationale and its language, but are we perhaps returning to an earlier period where the psychological health and well-being of prisoners did matter, perhaps more, or was a more defensible rationale than it maybe it has been in the sort of preceding 20 odd years.
Yeah, and to take it a bit further, because I'd noticed that the forensic psychology conference that you're presenting at in a few weeks' time, I should think probably, I may be exaggerating, 70% of the presentations include the term trauma-informed. And I looked at that and I thought, blimey, is just how deep is the kind of thinking behind these kind of labels that get applied, like trauma-informed or relational is another one, you know.
We're a massive fan of buzzwords, aren't we? And we develop our own sort of lingo and discourse, and phrases can work their way into routine language quite quickly, and trauma-informed seems to be one of them. And I find that quite fascinating. I mean, I love examining the discourse of psychologists, because sometimes the way we talk to each other, I think, is just incomprehensible to people, anyone other than ourselves. And again, that's something I've learned from the Prisons Research Centre, is how to just talk in quite human terms. I think we have a tendency, we borrowed a lot of medical language, and then we started borrowing kind of mindfulness-based concepts. We're playing with the systems-related concept right now. And I do wonder what prisoners think of terms like trauma-informed and resident and journey. I do wonder how people feel having these frameworks imposed on them. But, I mean, it's very interesting to examine the change in language throughout the historical record. I mean, you know, psychologists quite happily using terms that we would never dream of using now. And it's very easy to look back and be judgmental and think, well, you shouldn't be, talking about people like that, how disrespectful. But then you think, well, in 50 years' time, what are people going to think about it? I mean, you know, offenders is already a bit of a dirty word, isn't it? And rightfully so, but it's something that certainly until fairly recent times we were quite happy to use.
I think Naomi and I've found, just doing these podcasts and working with people with lived experience, we found it quite a chastening experience about our own use of language, even though we've regarded ourselves as being very sensitive and thoughtful.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think you have to be prepared to, ultimately, if we're serious about improving things and making things better, you have to be prepared to have your ego dented quite a lot, and to not take that as a personal threat or attack or whatever, because we get socialized into particular ways of talking about people. I'm sure I'll listen back to this podcast and think, oh God, the way you put that was a bit patronizing or condescending or whatever. Language really matters, but it's very hard to it's hard to see it, and then it's hard to change it, but it's absolutely important to do.
I think there's something about being, it reminds me about some of the discussions around race as well, but you have to be open to the fact that we're socialised into a culture, so we might well say things in a way that are really quite clumsy and hurtful at times, and we have to be open to having our attention drawn to that if things are going to change for the better. We can't just all get defensive every time. We don't like we've impacted on someone in a way that's hurtful, and it might be embarrassing to have that pointed out, but actually if we want to do better, then it is really important that people are freed up to point out those, how language kind of like keeps people in certain boxes.
Absolutely. And I think we have to confront our collective insecurities, maybe. For example, psychologists, certainly in prisons in the early days and perhaps also in courts too. I mean, you know, we were the psychiatrist's assistants. We were lowly compared to the medical officer who was mostly a psychiatrist. And we've sort of, fought our way to forge our own identity and to challenge the psychiatric paradigm. And we fought our way into trying to encourage prisons to see things a bit more psychologically. You know, we're always trying to push into a field where perhaps we're not terribly well respected or welcome or wanted. And I think that's got to do something to you collectively as a profession. I haven't quite worked out what it is yet, but I think it's certainly a salient part of our history that we're always trying to be the up and coming.
So the next step may be to ensure that forensic psychologists can work in better conditions and have a less punishing training route. Because I think they're important.
Might want to speak to the BPS about that. I mean, the training is changing and in some quite interesting ways. I mean, obviously with bringing in regulations that kind of changed the role of the BPS. Chargeship is now kind of an honorary title rather than the thing that you need to be able to practice legally. We have, an increasing number of training providers. Obviously, Cardiff has come onto the market as an alternative provider of registration without chargeship. And I think we're in a very kind of liminal time with regard to training. But I think the thing that I would like to see change is that it kind of becomes culturally accepted that, you're going to have to work your ass off basically to get trained, and you will be spending a lot of nights doing your practice diary. Your competency log, you'll have to do a lot to evidence things. I am hearing from people that that's got slightly better recently, but it's, once that level of labour becomes accepted, that's quite dangerous then, because it burns people out, takes people a long time to get qualified, and then often once people are qualified, they're a bit sick of the whole thing and leave. So it's kind of a bit of a vicious cycle that, I hope we can give due attention to what is the best way to do it. I'm not claiming to know the answer to that either, I should hasten to that. just that it's a repeated theme that people talk about as important.
Yeah, here's the people taking kind of like 9 years to... from embarking on training to qualify, and that just seems a ridiculous, I think it's one thing to work your ass off, as you say, for kind of like 3 years, but if you're doing that for 9 years, that's a very long commitment and interferes with life. But I have to say, when I first worked for the prison service in 1993, maybe, the qualification at Birkbeck had just been not approved. And so myself and a colleague were tasked with just going and start a psychology department at the Young Offenders, and no training or experience whatsoever, which really felt like just being let loose on people, really. So it's something about getting the balance right in the middle, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the opposite extreme. Wow. Well done.
So, Sophie, you've touched a bit upon the history of psychologists in prison, but what do you think psychologists today have forgotten about or just don't know?
So, I think that their institutional memory is just generally quite short, and why wouldn't it be? Your direct memory of how things are begins when you start your career. So understanding what things were like before then, you rely on people who have been longer, they're longer than you telling you about it. And there isn't an awful lot to read on the subject. So, yeah, the institutional memory of psychologists is quite short, which I think really influences the acceptance of things. So like the training group, for example, I said I was absolutely flabbergasted when I learned about what it was like back in the day. So you just kind of, you accept, oh, this is the way things are. You accept them as natural kinds rather than historical kinds, or, a product of a system that it might be very hard to change, but is ultimately malleable and changeable. So I think just forgetting that once upon a time, psychologists in prison were not all forensic psychologists, weren't even forensic psychologists at all, because that didn't exist as a formal kind of nomination. But psychologists used to do a much wider range of jobs in the prison, and were much less kind of formalised and standardised. Those are the main sort of changes that we're likely to face. I also love how psychologists, we almost have kind of origin myths, right? You know, when you ask a psychologist, what's our history? Why are we here? What you'll typically get is, oh, well, Martinson decided that nothing works from his research, and then, psychologists came in, Andrews and Bonser, and did these meta-analyses and, brought us the R&R model, which showed what did work, and we're all kind of familiar with that narrative. When you actually go back and read the primary sources, you realise that the Martinson myth has been vastly distorted over time. Martinson was not the first to do evaluations of this nature. His original paper isn't saying that nothing works. He changed his own mind about his stuff within a relatively short period of time. There were kind of various political developments in the 70s that meant that the environment was very favourable to elevating his particular study. Although initially the New York Prison Service tried to suppress it because they didn't like the fact that he wasn't saying that what they were doing was working enormously well. He had to he basically had to take them to court to get hold of his own data in order to be able to publish it, which I think is a great story. These things that we're sort of told a very watered down version of are actually much more complicated and kind of disturb the simplistic narrative that we have of why we're here and why we do what we do. And I think we also, we've lost, in historical study, you can have the kind of great man / great woman histories of key players in a history. And you can also have, the voices and the histories of what might call ordinary people or histories of the oppressed and so on. And it's very interesting to look for prisoners' voices about psychologists in the published archive. Inside Time is an enormous repository of very valuable data, where I think it's very easy to dismiss it as, oh, well, it's just people writing to the papers to complain. But actually, the nature and the patterns of the complaints have a consistency that tells us something about how prisoners have felt about us over the years. So I really think we should be paying more attention to those kinds of changes.
How long have psychologists been working in prisons?
Well, it depends what you mean by working in prisons, but basically for pretty much as long as psychology has been around generally. The earliest record that I can find of a psychologist in prison is actually 1855 in Pentonville Prison. Yeah, which is way earlier than I ever expected. And the psychologist in question is, I should give this full enunciation, called Forbes Benignus Winslow. I mean, how's that for a name? And he, in the documentation, he's consulted by the chief medical officer, who wants some help in understanding a prisoner in Pentonville, referred to as H.G., and I quote about H.G. H.G. had been formerly an industrious and respectable man, a regular attendant at his church, but after sustaining heavy pecuniary losses, became dejected and perplexed himself by an overcurious reading of the Bible. and finally, without any assignable motive, fired his neighbour's haystack. So I'd like to get Theresa Gannon on that one. Winslow was consulted by the chief medical officer as, you know, what do we do with this person? But it's not really that straightforward, because even though the medical officer is referring to Winslow as a psychologist, he's not likely to have called himself that. He and other people refer to him as a psychiatrist, although he did found the Quarterly Journal of Psychological Medicine. So this kind of just shows the ontological fluidity around the psi disciplines at the time and what was the province of whom type thing. The first time we find psychologists working in prisons, well, the earliest example is in 1905 in Minnesota State Prison. And I have to credit Margaret Sharp LeRoy for her excellent history of that prison. But psychology took off in the States much, much earlier than here in prisons. In Britain, we're talking sort of around 1932-33, where we find a report of a psychologist attached to Wandsworth Prison. Called William DeBarge Hubert, so another fantastic name. And his job was to assess incoming prisoners for suitability for various kinds of intervention. And he eventually produces a report in 1939 saying 80% of offenders are psychologically normal and respond to routine punishment, but a minority might respond to psychological treatment. Language a bit different, or not so different, but still this idea of kind of assessment and sifting people into different types of intervention, which I think is quite fascinating, really.
Why is knowing about psychology's history so helpful, you know, in terms of going back and uncovering this? I can see as a psychologist it's interesting to hear about these predecessors, but I suppose I'm wondering if, you know, what's the benefit to us as a profession to know about this?
I'm now quite intrigued by the idea of history as therapy, because I've actually found it quite therapeutic myself to make sense of things. You know, I think there are a lot of things when I was working in prison that just didn't make sense to me. I was like, why are things like this? And actually, you can find the answers. You can read about changes and developments and come to understand, okay, things are this way now because of that. It's rarely that simple, but there's something about with understanding, I think, helps you to contextualise the role. And it's kind of emancipatory as well. So, like, it encourages, because you can see differences and that nothing is sacred, shall we say, even the things that we are perhaps taught are sacred, it really encourages critical thought, and it expands your vision for change. But it also guards against being overzealous. I think one of the things we can be quite guilty of as psychologists is, you know, we do really want to do things well. And if we, you know, latch onto something that seems like it might make things better, we really like it and we really go for it. But when you start to see kind of cycles of different things, I think it guards you against being too overzealous about anything being a magic bullet. And, you know, there's obviously things about, I don't know how effective history actually is at avoiding repeating past mistakes, but, you know, possibly. And certainly in terms of, you know, imperial and racialized history and the role of prisons in those kinds of activities, hopefully avoid replicating oppressive practices. And, you know, our job affects people's lives, so I kind of feel like the more informed we can be, the better.
Absolutely, that makes a lot of sense. I wondered how psychologists that you have responded to the fact that you're doing this research, is it something that's been welcomed?
Absolutely wonderfully, for the most part. I mean, it's a bit of a tricky situation at the moment because there's a moratorium on research in prisons, which means that I'm not allowed to interview currently employed prison psychologists. But there are plenty of psychologists who have many years of experience in prisons but don't work for them currently. And they've been extraordinarily generous with their time, their honesty, their willingness to co-theorise. To make sense together collectively. There's a real appetite for deconstructing some of the things that are salient on their minds. And it really has at times felt like a collective effort to move towards something better. And that's been really, really nice. That's been a real privilege. But I think also a level of sometimes talking about things that you feel are not quite right can be like quite scary. So I think there's a level of worry about, I think just because we're working in such a complex area, people want to be really sure of themselves and feel really kind of safe and like they're doing the right thing. And then you spot something that you feel is not quite right and you're like, oh my God, that's quite a big thing to confront.
I think there's something about forensic practice, isn't there, that makes people worry about the consequences of what they do or say in a way that might not be there for other areas of work. But a number of our guests have spoken about the need for greater emotional literacy in the criminal justice system, and I wondered, is this something that you've become more conscious of for prison-based psychologists since moving out of prisons?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I started, well, I'm still learning really, to understand the difference between, there's a psychology of the mind and there's a psychology of the soul, I think. And I think we're very good at the mind version. You know, obviously there's been the trend over the years to adopt quite a cognitive paradigm to things. But the aspiration is often very much emotional management, so, you know, control your feelings, which, you know, often is quite beneficial to people, but maybe that means we skip over a bit the understanding of feelings and of existential matters that, really do feed into emotions and how we feel. Mm. And, I haven't actually said this to him yet, so he might hear it for the first time on this podcast, but I have to say, Ben Crewe's new book, Life, Imprisonment and Young Adulthood, where he and his team trace the experiences of people given life sentences very young. There's some fantastic psychology in that, but it's not the type of psychology that I think we're typically trained to do. It's a real kind of thick description of the emotion of what serving that sentence means. And it's very good, and I sort of think, yeah, I'd like to get better at that sort of psychology.
Thank you. And just as we're kind of like needing to draw to a close, really, in terms of time, I just wondered if you could tell us a bit about what's coming next for you in terms of your activities. I know you've got some exciting things ahead.
Yeah. Well, as I said, in a few weeks there'll be a presentation at the DFP conference where I will be attempting to trace the racialized history of forensic psychology, because I think if we're serious about our efforts to address the sort of things that came into the prominence with the Black Lives Matter movement, then we need to properly understand our role and our complicity in that, and how psychology is interwoven with a lot of racial issues. But also there is going to be, hopefully, a seminar series called Critical Conversations in Psychology, which is going to be a series of four online seminars, which are, you know, open for everybody to attend. Very much hoping that it will be a gathering space for psychologists who are interested in having some critical conversations about forensic issues. It's called Critical Conversations in both the sense that there is, I think the message that I'm getting from an awful lot of psychologists is that there is a hunger for a greater plurality of perspectives. They're very keen for that, and also critical in terms of timely. There are a number of serious issues with the prison system at the moment, and we need to do everything we can about them, basically. Each seminar is going to have a non-psychologist speaker and a psychologist discussant. The idea being that equips us as practitioners with new theoretical fuel, but it also kind of fosters interdisciplinary dialogue. and being able to kind of hook into some of the debates around the big issues. The issues that we're going to focus on are punishment, economy, empire, and knowledge. Knowledge meaning kind of some of the epistemological issues that affect our practice. So very much hoping that people will be interested in that. Probably the best way to hook up to information about it at the moment is to follow me on Twitter. So I'm psych_SEllis, capital E, capital S. And there'll be some various advertising and websites and Twitter accounts and stuff going up in a few weeks as well. So, yeah. Hope to see people
there.
That's
brilliant. That's brilliant. And we could share any links as well so that people are able to easily access those.
Absolutely. And the PhD research itself is also very much still going on, not so much for the historical stuff, but for the contemporary strand of the study. If you're a psychologist with experience in prisons and you'd like to be interviewed about the kind of experiences and making sense of the kind of social and the moral landscape that you have to navigate, then get in touch. My email is sle43@cam.ac.uk. As I said, at the moment there is a moratorium on interviewing currently employed psychologists. So if you have experience but you don't work for them anymore and you'd like to do an interview, then great. If you do work for prisons and you're interested, then you're very welcome to express that interest. And once prisons are open for research again, then we can go from there.
Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thank you.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff, Sophie, and I hope we have you back again next year.
Thank you, that would be a pleasure.
That was a really nice conversation with Sophie. After all, she is somebody who's really kind of paid her dues. I mean, she's worked for 10 years in the prison service, doing a lot of contact work and program work. So she really knows what she's talking about. And of course, she's used that opportunity to think about things and then move into a situation where she's now able to begin a deeper level of study. I thought there were a number of interesting things that arose. One was about power, again, and the idea that psychologists are perceived as having power in relation to incarcerated people. That is, they write reports and they may often have a serious effect on the future for people. So that's a particular kind of power. And we talked a bit about psychiatrists and how they have are seen to have a power in relation to the institution, which can be rather frightening for prison governors. I thought other points that Sophie made were in relation to the position of psychologists. She said, we have some similarities to prisoners, that we both are striving for recognition and perhaps a bit on the outside trying to get in. Of course, in relation to our training, we have no end point to it, so it's a bit like being on an indeterminate sentence. I thought that was very striking.
Yeah, I think the kind of like the trainee route has become so kind of like long and complex for people. Yeah, I thought that was an interesting analogy. I suppose something else that struck me was how similar it sounds to the way that educational psychology has gone as well. So I found it's a bit disheartening, really, to hear about people joining to work in the prison service because they want to make a difference and they really want to help people who are living in prison grow and make positive change in their life. But then there was a sense of the role sometimes being more restrictive in terms of what it's possible to do, which reminded me of educational psychologists getting caught up in so much statementing of not that they're not able to do the task of helping the children in school, that which is what they, you know, I think is the motivation behind people joining. So it's a bit sad to hear that somebody who's got that, you could really hear Sophie's passion about the role of forensic psychologists in prison. And in some ways it's a bit sad that she left because she felt that she wasn't going to be able to quite fulfil that role in the way that she wanted to. But that's obviously tempered by this project she's doing. Sounds really interesting, and it sounds like a lot will come out of that that's likely to be really beneficial for the profession as a whole. So yeah, quite mixed feelings at the end of that one.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.